From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we talk with Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas about police accountability. Then the convention may be scaled down, but it's still happening. We look at how Milwaukee hosting the DNC could help Democrats win Wisconsin.
It makes sense for the Democrats to go someplace where this might be enough to tip the balance and where they want every single vote because they expect the state to be razor thin.
Plus, we speak with chef and owner of Lazy Susan on the challenges of keeping a restaurant running during a pandemic.
I'm people over profit, always. Right now, if I can sustain my business like this, it's not ideal. But if I can do it and if I'm smart about it, I should just keep doing this for as long as I have to.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Protesters around the country have been taking to the streets since May to speak out against police brutality. Here in Milwaukee, activists are calling for police reforms and accountability. Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas has publicly said he supports discussions about reforming police departments. But he's quick to emphasize that, in his opinion, police officers are tasked with solving too many of the problems in our community. And he takes issue with people faulting police for many of these failures. He joins me by Zoom to talk more about police accountability and potential reforms. Sheriff Lucas, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, you know, there have been all of these ongoing protests here in Milwaukee County in general, but specifically in the city of Milwaukee. How have you responded? What has your reaction been to these protests and the criticism of local law enforcement?
Well, any conversation that I have regarding protests begins with what we witnessed back on May 25th. And that is one of the more reprehensible acts that shows the depth of man's inhumanity to man in the actions of four former Minneapolis police officers who took the life of one Mr. George Floyd in a way that many of us found the most deplorable, reprehensible act that one could ever imagine. And since that time, we've seen the protests break out in cities all across America, including in Minneapolis, Seattle, Atlanta, Richmond, and Milwaukee, just to name a few. I get it. I understand that people are frustrated and they're enraged by people losing their lives at the hands of those sworn to protect and serve the people. And so I get the frustration and I get the outrage. And there's been a number of calls at the federal, state, and local levels for change to happen, to occur in law enforcement. And I get that and understand that as well. But if we're going to have any dialogue and discussion as to what the future looks like, it must be a discussion on all things. Must be a discussion on the education system, the healthcare system, the employment system, certainly mental health, homelessness, and other systems that when they collapse on the law enforcement profession. And those are issues that we are not prepared to deal with. Because we're, despite our best efforts, we're not, you know, trained to deal with persons in mental health crisis. We're not trained to deal with persons that are have addictive behaviors, nor are we trained to deal with those juveniles with emotional issues. Yet, all of those issues collapse and fall on law enforcement. So we do the very best we possibly can. If we're going to have this discussion, and I'm sorry for that. If we're going to have this discussion, it's got to be one where everybody's at the table, including law enforcement, is seated at the table for us to have a wholesome and healthy discussion on what the future looks like moving forward in our country.
You know, you mentioned a lot of things inside of that, especially mental health being a big thing that impacts your work. And of course, inside of these protests, we've heard a lot of people calling to defund the police. And as part of that, many of them are saying we need to shift resources to people who are trained to deal with some of these situations, to people who are better equipped to deal with someone experiencing a mental health crisis. What do you think of these calls to defund the police and shift that money elsewhere?
Well, it must be a more robust dialogue than just simply to defund the police. We've got to look at what do we have our police doing. There's 18,000 police agencies in this country and over 800,000 men and women serving in this noble profession. And people ask us to do things from a range of, again, respond to those persons that are suffering mental health crises. Respond to calls of persons who have overdosed or have addictive behaviors. And then on the lower end, they have us responding to calls of loud music or barking dog complaints and other disorderly acts. If we're going to have a discussion in these regarding these 18,000 agencies, and on what it is that each of these communities want them to have, then we've got to then have a robust dialogue on if we're going to look at shifting resources from police agencies to other agencies and other programs in our communities, then what are we going to ask the police to take off their plate? That's where the conversation has got to begin. What do we want to take off the police plate? Is it the stuff on the top end, the real critical issues, or is it the more menial tasks that, again, agencies throughout the country and municipalities all across the country are not dealing with? Who then will deal with those issues if the police are not responding to them? Once we figure those things out, I think the discussion and dialogue regarding reprioritizing, shifting funds is appropriate.
Well, in an ideal world, what do you think the role of the police should be in our community?
It's very basic. It's the one that, going back to the early days of the London Metropolitan Police Department, which is recognized by many as the first professional police agency in the world, is that we are there to address those issues of crime and disorder in our communities, where we wouldn't want or have the military to do that. The military has a function, as we know, to protect this nation against foreign and domestic foes. But the police have a role of, again, protecting and serving our communities, and also, too, to respond to those calls for service in our respective communities. So it's very basic. It's not changed from the days of the first founding of law enforcement in the world, but the demands have changed. The dynamics have changed, whether it be the advent of the 911 system, whether it been the introduction of technology into the profession and in our society, for that matter, as well. And there's so many other factors that have weighed into what it is that we do that, again, we need to have and think about. Again, what does the conversation look like when it comes to shifting priorities in our communities, shifting funding, and more importantly, what do we leave for the police to do?
As you say, there is a lot on the plate of the police forces in our community, but there's also been issues with excessive force, with black-white disparities that people want to fix, that people want to change. What kind of reforms do you think we need here in Milwaukee County?
Well, that certainly is a challenge at all police leaders and sheriffs around the country have, is the issue of force. It is a very delicate subject in law enforcement. We're taught and trained to use techniques ranging from, verbal commands to placing of hands on an individual to any of the other tools that are available to us that are less lethal. And then in those rare and unfortunate circumstances, the use of deadly force. I don't know of any police agency in the country that is teaching its officers to use techniques like what we witnessed on Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis. I don't know of any police agency in the country that teaches its members to use chokeholds like what we witnessed a few years ago with one Mr. Eric Garner. Those are examples of officers who violate policies and procedures and protocols and resort to measures that have long been banned and outlawed in this profession. We have some of the highest standards in law enforcement. I say we're held to a higher standard, and we ought to be proud. So the 800 hours of training that a Milwaukee County Sheriff's deputy or any law enforcement officer in the state of Wisconsin received includes a number of areas that prepare us to do the job as best as we possibly can. Yet you're going to have a small percentage of individuals, whether it's in law enforcement or whether it's in banking or whether it's in healthcare and sports and others, who take shortcuts, who use other measures, whether banned or inappropriate. And what we've got to do is find ways to rid our profession of those individuals, because when they do acts like what we witnessed in Minneapolis, it hurts all of our profession. It hurts everyone.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm chatting with Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas. It seems like this is part of a larger issue, though. You know, you mentioned Minneapolis, of course, but basically a very similar thing happened in New York. We've seen similar things happen to unarmed black men in cities around the country, and it's not an isolated issue. You know, you bring up there are bad actors in a lot of different fields, but in many fields, bad actors don't lead to death. So I think, like, what a lot of protesters, what a lot of activists are looking for is, how do we reform the system so these bad actors either aren't doing these things or they're held accountable?
Well, that's a good place to start, holding us accountable. I think police chiefs and sheriffs are doing just that around the country. They're holding those individuals that are responsible for these acts accountable. We see the four former Minneapolis police officers have been fired and have been charged with crimes. We see the officers down in Atlanta who used excessive force. They've been charged with crimes. We even seen where the officers who were trying to allow those to exercise their First Amendment rights in Buffalo, and they had a very unfortunate encounter with a individual, a gentleman, a senior, and those officers have been charged. So the system does hold us accountable. But, you know, we're talking about reforms. What do we want to do? How do we want to change the system? I think, by and large, the police do fairly well at policing ourselves. We are all looking at the training that we provide our men and women. And is it the very best and to the highest standards and consistent with best practices around the country? We have early warning systems to detect those individuals who have a high number of incidents of excessive force. We have disciplinary protocols in place to address those individuals, from everything from counseling to retraining to termination. So we have everything in place. It's a matter of how effective are we applying any one or all of those is the question. So when we talk about reform, again, it's not a question of whether, well, the police are not doing something. Yes, we have all of those in place. It's just, are we applying them to the level and to the degree that many observers are saying that we could or we should?
Well, and that gets to another question. You know, when it comes to reforming the police, I think ultimately what people are looking at is not perhaps the systems, but the end impact. And if people are still dying at the hands of police when they are unarmed in situations where the force is excessive, how effective are these measures? What are some of the definitive things that let you know whether or not these kinds of measures are effective? What is your criteria for success?
Well, a lot of what we do in this profession is not, you can't measure it. How do you measure the absence of crime? You know, people are always saying, well, how effective do we know? Do we need that many police in a community? And it's hard to say that would a crime had taken place, whether an officer was there or was not there. So how effective are we? I guess it depends on who you're asking. I like to think that by and large, we address those issues in our profession of misuse of force or excessive force. I like to think that we have a very strict code of conduct and ethics and morals that we adhere to in our profession. And that individuals who do not adhere to those are dealt with in an appropriate fashion. Let us remember, too, that law enforcement officers are human beings as well. And they have certain rights and privileges afforded to them that any individual that enters into the criminal justice system would have. And thus, it's not the police chief or it's not the sheriff who is not doing his or her job. Oftentimes, those individuals go before a jury or a judge and either have decisions overturned that police chiefs and sheriffs have made or are awarded their jobs back. And those are just judiciary decisions that are made that even to the irritation of some police chiefs and sheriffs.
Well, part of that is the issue of qualified immunity. Do you agree with removing qualified immunity for police?
Do we allow doctors to practice without some type of malpractice insurance? Do we allow many others in our society to perform in their duties without some degree of immunity? So no, I would not be one supportive of a removal of qualified immunity. It's a discussion that we could have and how it could be changed. But all the men and women that serve in this profession don't come doing it and expecting that that if they make one decision, whether right or wrong, good or bad, that it could lead to them losing their livelihood, losing their family, losing their homes, losing their freedom. So it's a discussion I think we're way from having a definitive answer to the question. But again, it's part of a robust dialogue that we can have, but it just doesn't begin all or nothing. Let's eliminate it altogether. No, that's not what we want to do. How do we make it work for everybody involved?
Well, how do you think we make it work for everyone involved?
I'm but one person in this system. I can only speak from my perspective.
Yeah.
And that, well, again, I said it's necessary and that we must have some assurances, just like in every other profession. Look at what broadcasters do. The views and opinions of this host are not that of this radio station. That's a form of immunity that shields that station from that reporter or that writer. So every profession has some degree or some form of immunity or make exceptions. And so it's something that, again, when we are having a robust discussion and dialogues, let's begin to talk about what that looks like.
The stakes, though, at least when it comes to my profession, are very different. There hasn't been someone, you know, suffocated as a result of my words. My words can't put a knee on someone's neck.
I'd like to think that the media in America, which I find to be a very noble estate, but let's face it, has done some attacks on some people of their livelihoods. And yes, there are consequences of some of the reporting that has occurred in the history of our country. So again, when we're pointing fingers, let's make sure we're not mindful of the fact that when you point one finger, four fingers come back at the individual that's pointing. And so therefore, yes, there's enough for all of us that goes around for all of us when it comes to who's accountable for what in this country. No, there's no direct correlation to your point. But yes, I would argue that, what the media has done to end some lives, some livelihoods, and some careers has been borderline, again, criminal acts. And so, yes, there's more than enough finger pointing and blame to go around.
I'm not sure that the end of someone's career could quite be compared to the end of someone's life, but
we can
move forward from this.
Can we move on? Thank you.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the obstacles to improving police community relations, with which you've admitted are problematic?
Perception is a major one. Perception reported in the media, the 24-hour news cycle, the advent of everybody's a roving reporter with cell phone cameras and the like. There are so many barriers and impediments to having robust discussions and dialogues on how we improve and enhance relations. So there's just not one, there's many.
When I hear that, though, that sounds like more accountability, that people are taking videos, people are seeing what the police are doing more frequently, and hence want more accountability for their actions.
Okay.
Why is that perception wrong? Why do you think that's more of an obstacle instead of something that's helpful to keep people accountable?
Because there is, in this country, a right to privacy. People have a right to privacy, which is protected in the Constitution. So some of the intrusions that we see because of those that are social media's cameras everywhere in the public space, it does infringe and borders on depriving an individual of their right to privacy. So again, there's so many issues out there that we can discuss. I'm all about transparency. I'm all about accountability. And this sheriff has said that, this sheriff has shown that in all of my discussions. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to hear me and speaking to this community, that we're not perfect people. What we are proud professionals, and we do our very best, and we hold ourselves accountable. And those that violate our values, our mores, we do our very best to weed them out. We would ask that in every walk of life, whether it's in Congress, whether it's in business, whether it's in athletics, and even in media, that everybody turn that camera, turn that spotlight on everybody in each one of those professions as well, and make those difficult decisions to read out that. Look at what's going on at some of the major news outlets and how a number of their anchors, executives, have been caught up in the Me Too movement and scandals, and how difficult, even as recent, it was to rid that individual from coming over our airwaves each day. So again, when we point a finger in one direction, be mindful of the fact that four comes pointing back at those that are making claims.
That was Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas. Coming up, although the DNC is going to be pared down, it will still be coming to Milwaukee. We look at how that could impact voting here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. The Democratic National Convention was originally scheduled for this week in Milwaukee. It was moved to next month over concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. And while there are still questions about what exactly is going to happen in Milwaukee, we know it won't include the 50,000 visitors and $200 million economic boost we had anticipated. But Milwaukee is still the convention's host city, and that could mean an advantage for Democrats. This week, as we mark what should have been the DNC, we're going to re-examine some of the reasons why Milwaukee might have been chosen to host the convention. Christopher B. Mann co-authored the paper Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact of National Party Convention Location, that appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida in March. He starts by asking why Milwaukee is a logical choice for the 2020 DNC.
Milwaukee does make sense. Wisconsin is an important state, and the research that my colleagues and I did found that when the DNC hosts their convention, in that media market, we would expect a positive effect for the DNC, as long as that media market, in general terms, leans towards the Democrats, and the Milwaukee media market certainly does that. So while there might be other sites that you could argue might also be good choices, Milwaukee is certainly a very sensible choice from a tactical point of view if the Democrats want to cash in on this historical pattern. Of course, historical patterns, no guarantee, but probably the logic behind the choice of Milwaukee.
Sure. But, I mean, there's a lot of cities that skew Democratic, but, you know, people were somewhat surprised, I mean, I wouldn't say entirely surprised, but somewhat surprised that Wisconsin turned red in 2016 or went so kind of overwhelmingly red. So even though Milwaukee and the media market that makes up this, you know, southeast corner of Wisconsin is certainly, you know, pretty Democratic, it does it have an effect on how things go statewide?
One of the important things about our research is that we're looking at the media market and not the whole state. So earlier research had looked at the state and found little, if any, evidence that hosting a convention was moving statewide numbers. But most conventions are held in big cities and big states. And so they're, you know, a local effect wouldn't necessarily be seen statewide. And what we see is an effect that will be on the order of a couple of percentage points from Milwaukee in the Milwaukee media market. That will be even less when it's sort of spread across the statewide totals, all the places in Wisconsin that are not part of the Milwaukee media market. It's an opportunity to maybe take advantage and get this boost in a state that is close, has been close in presidential elections and close in lots of other elections. And, you know, every advantage is something that the parties seek. And so it makes sense from that point of view.
Sure. And in that regard, the size of the media market, because you're studying media markets, makes sense here. I mean, I think of the 2016 DNC, which happened in Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania has a few different media markets that are heavily Democratic. But here in Wisconsin, there's pretty much just this really big one around Milwaukee, another one kind of by Madison, but they're kind of close by. So it seems like the balance is there, whereas in other states, the Democratic representation is a little bit more of a patchwork.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Democrats picked Philadelphia. It's the largest media market in Pennsylvania for 2016. They picked Milwaukee, which is the largest media market, as well as the most Democratic-friendly media market in terms of past voting history. And when you compare Milwaukee to some other cities, the media market as a share of Wisconsin is bigger than we see in other states, right? Philadelphia, while it's the largest, is not as disproportionately large, because you have Pittsburgh and a variety of other sort of small and medium-sized markets in Pennsylvania. And you could go through a number of other swing states, right? Your neighbors across Lake Michigan and to the north and the UP, right? Michigan has many more media markets. It's harder to have as big a share as you would potentially capitalize this benefit in Wisconsin by coming to Milwaukee.
Sure, and they're also farther apart there, whereas here it's kind of concentrated.
Yes.
So I'm also curious. I mean, you researched the effect that Democratic conventions have and Republican conventions, and for some reason, the Republican conventions don't have the same effect as the Democratic conventions. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not wildly different effects. What we see is primarily an effect on persuasion, and we see both a positive effect in places that lean towards the party hosting the convention and a backlash effect in areas that already lean against the convention. What's really striking about the Democrats is this is a much steeper difference. The Democrats get bigger benefits where they get benefits, and they get bigger backlash where they get backlash. But what this adds up to, when you think about cities, is that most city centers are very strongly Democratic, and the suburbs tend to move into swing areas, and the large proportion of the big urban area media markets are leaning Democratic. That's part of why Democrats get a big boost. What we don't know is why this sort of, it's a much steeper line, if you will, where Democrats get a stronger benefit and a stronger backlash than the Republicans do. That may be the nature of the party. It may be way in which nominees resonate, or something about the way the parties present themselves at the convention. We've certainly been curious about that and thought about it a little bit, but we didn't identify anything that we could confidently say was a pattern that defines why the Democratic convention has this stronger local effect than the Republican convention.
Sure. And when you say that there's an inverse effect for the party voting against the one that is hosting the convention with regards to Wisconsin, I mean, following your theory, would you then say that we can predict in some senses a smaller Republican voter turnout in Wisconsin come November?
So we tried to separate the phenomenon of turnout, that is mobilizing people who might not otherwise vote, versus persuading people who are deciding between the two parties. And so what we would expect to see here is that in the red counties within the Milwaukee media market, they'll be a little bit redder. The blue counties will be a little bit bluer. And the net effect of that, because Milwaukee is so much larger, when you add this up and cumulatively across the media market of Milwaukee as the host city, that should advantage the Democrats because they get a boost of several percentage points in those, from those Democrats in the area. The trade-off is they lose, some more people in other areas that might be leaning Republican, shifting towards Republican. But the net is a blue boost when you add up everything in the entire media market.
Sure. So it's a matter of density and the kind of rule of thumb that more dense areas, urban areas, tend to skew more Democratic.
Yeah. When you add things up, that is why it comes out to be a net benefit to the Democrats. In Milwaukee, you're obviously much more interested in the Democratic convention. But if you were hosting the Republican convention, right, it would almost be dangerous. The effects are weaker for that Republican convention, but there would be more support from Republican-leaning areas for Republicans, but there would also be more votes for Democrats. And because there are so many more Democrats, hosting the Republican convention is actually, according to the historical pattern, to the Democrats' advantage.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WWM 89.7 FM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Hydon. We're talking with Christopher Mann. He co-wrote the paper, Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact on National Party Convention Location, which appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. We're talking a little bit about how conventions affect the local voting dynamics. And I'm curious, do you think or do you know that the party leadership, whether it be the Democrats, the Republicans, or any of the other parties, behind closed doors, do they make the kinds of considerations that we're talking about? I mean, how actively do they consider where to place their conventions?
Before we did this research, they certainly considered it in general terms. We looked at what they had said publicly and looked at, historical documents about the presidential nomination process and debates about where to put the convention. It's pretty clear that people were thinking about this as an opportunity to highlight and impact those states and thinking about it. Since we wrote this article. My colleagues and I have had conversations with various party officials that suggest that they were aware of it going into 2016. You know, I don't want to claim too much of an impact, but I think the conversation continues that they can have an impact, that this does matter to each of the parties and their prospects for the presidential nominees.
Right, and I mean, all of the think pieces that came out of 2016, all of the kind of post-mortem analysis that came out seem to have pointed out to dropping the ball on Michigan and Wisconsin in particular.
Yeah, it's unsurprising to see Wisconsin, right? For the Democrats, there's a lot of talk about the path back through the industrial Midwest, and Wisconsin is right at the front of that list. So it's unsurprising that that was the region that Democrats wanted to go to make their case to the voters, right? There's a lot of symbolism about being there beyond that local effect. We point out in our research, you know, that there's a longstanding pattern that the conventions provide a boost to each of the nominees as they occur, and that's as people tune in and what they see. But I'm sure we can expect the Democrats to highlight a lot of the kinds of themes that are important to voters in the Midwest, because in order to assemble an electoral college coalition, the backdrop of being in Milwaukee and what it means to be a major Midwestern city is going to be part of what they want to convey, not just to local voters, but to voters throughout the Midwest and throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that Houston was a finalist to host the 2020 DNC, and a lot there seems to be this divide also among the Democratic Party as to whether or not you focus on the Midwest or do you focus on Latino and Black communities in the South, flipping Texas, for example. And it seems to be they've fallen on the kind of the forgotten man of the Midwest with this convention decision.
Yeah, and I think there was also some discussion of the fact that hosting the convention in Texas, right, if there is a bump from hosting the convention there that's felt at the local and state level, Texas is a big reach. You know, if it had been somewhere else in the Southwest, in Colorado, which is a very competitive state, or Arizona, which the Democrats are trying to make competitive, right, frankly, those cities might have been stronger contenders against Milwaukee with the argument of the path to the White House runs through an electoral college strategy built around the Southwest as opposed to the Midwest. But right, for reasons that I don't claim any special insight into, but the case for the Midwest seems to have won out in that debate about where to host the convention, and thus it's in your fair city.
Fascinating. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Mann is a political scientist at Skidmore College. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida in March. We'll take a short break, then hear from a Milwaukee restaurant owner about her decision to remain closed. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's restaurants are navigating a challenging balancing act during this pandemic. When the lockdown was first ordered in March, carryout was the only option allowed. Then, starting June 5th, with about a day's notice from the city, Milwaukee restaurants and bars were able to reopen dining spaces and outdoor seating. Those restaurants had to weigh capacity restrictions, social distancing requirements, and other safety measures to calculate whether operating was really worth it. After reopening dine-in services to the public, there are now over a dozen Milwaukee restaurants that have temporarily closed their doors again, as either employees or customers who entered their buildings have tested positive for the coronavirus. For the restaurant Lazy Susan in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood, they've remained open for carryout services only, and they don't plan to make dine-in services available anytime soon. Lazy Susan's chef and owner, A.J. Dixon, joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the challenges of adapting her restaurant shortly after the June 5th announcement was made.
A.J. Dixon, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So on Friday, June 4th, the city of Milwaukee announced that bars and restaurants could open up the following day at 2 p.m. So what was your initial response to this sudden announcement?
It was no. And what the hell? Pardon my French. With everything going on in the city right now, are you kidding me? And, you know, a few of us other local businesses got on the phone together and talked about it. And I felt that it was kind of like a shot in the knees in terms of like a movement that's going on with the city. And that I felt that it was, I felt that it was used as a distraction tactic to kind of, you know, pull people from one thing over to another thing. That's my personal feeling on it.
Right. Recently, you posted a picture of yourself with a sign that says, "In solidarity, we will stay closed. We will not be a distraction."
Correct. Because that's how I felt. Like, I felt like there are much bigger things to deal with and, you know, to focus on than, you know, than bars and restaurants opening. And that movement needs the attention, not us.
And before the announcements, was there any communication before that? You know, rules, regulations, guidelines in place to help restaurants reopen?
Okay, so there is lots and lots and lots and lots of guidelines that have been going on. So you've got WITIC, you've got National Restaurant Association, you've got Wisconsin Restaurant Association, you've got, you know, even your distributors such as a Sysco or a Reinhardt or a US Foods, and all of these places, as well as the CDC. Everyone has guidelines, quote, guidelines for you to follow at your discretion. And what's going to work for me is not going to work for someone else. So it's kind of like, you know, you need to take all of these things and all of these lists, and it's very overwhelming, and read through all of them and go, okay, there's a similarity between all of them. So, you know, there's that, you know, like all of them say you should, you know, it's recommended to wear masks. Some suggest barriers, some do not suggest barriers. Some suggest, you know, gloves, some do not suggest gloves. So it's kind of like, you got to go through all of these things and just kind of take, like, you know, what you think is going to work for your establishment and then figure out a way how to implement it. About 3 weeks ago, I took it upon myself that I compiled like a webinar for other business owners where I went through all of the guidelines that were out there at that current moment and put them all together and compacted, you know, all of the similarities together. So it wasn't like you were reading like four different types of guidelines, just to kind of streamline it. And then I took things that I felt were important that weren't listed in there, like things that you wouldn't think about, you know, in a daily basis. Like, for example, like if you have staff that has facial piercings, that's more areas of risk of possible transmission because they'll be more inclined to want to touch their faces. You know, it's like, you know, do you wear masks in the kitchen? Because, you know, the whole big thing right now is touching your face. But then if you're in a kitchen and you're trying to taste food, what are you doing? You're constantly taking your mask on and off, which means it's more hand-to-face contact. And these are all things that I felt needed to be discussed and different ways to implement and different ways to be safe in mitigating the risk of spreading coronavirus. And these are all things that like aren't listed in a lot of these guidelines. So the discussion was very real. And, you know, we held this PowerPoint and, you know, I did one for staff. For staff of other establishments if they wanted to choose some, and then I did some for business owners too.
So in contrast to that, what was the communication or guidelines like from the city when you first learned that you had to close dine-in services during the initial adjustment to the pandemic, you know, on the flip side of this?
Okay, so we chose to close pretty much before, you know, the actual "we are closing" kind of a thing. I knew it was coming. I called all my staff in. We had a staff meeting. The decision was, we're not going to close because I can't afford to close at all. With this happening all over, I said, the unemployment is going to be so backlogged. I said, you know, I'm not laying anybody off. I suggested if you want to just file and get it in the pipeline. I had some staff members that like work one day a week. That were kind of like, you know, they have full-time jobs and they were okay. They were like, you know, well, we'll give these hours to another staff member. And then we pretty much came up with a plan of we're just going to do takeout. We moved a cooler. We operate out of a window. And it was just like, we need to do this to survive and we need to do this to sustain. And like closing was not an option for us. So there was just it was a big shock kind of a thing. Like, is this really happening kind of a thing? So.
And since deciding to close and shift operations, how have you been doing so far in regards to running a takeaway business during a pandemic?
Yeah, It just sounds so funny. I mean, but not funny. It's not funny. We're doing okay. We could always be doing better. We could be doing a lot worse. Some weeks are better than others. Right now, we're doing Wednesday, Thursday, Fridays. We tried doing more days than that in the very beginning, and we just noticed that there wasn't that much of a drop. So we just kind of adjusted things differently. So we've been doing pre-order only for the day before. And the reason why I do this is because we're only doing one menu item a night. I'm creating enough work for the people that I have on staff. There is no waste. I'm ordering exactly what I need. I'm monitoring my expenses very carefully, which at a time like this is really, really important because there is really no error for waste or for mistakes, because right now we only have X amount of money coming in the door, and that's to pay staff and pay rent and, you know, pay vendors and things. So, I mean, some weeks could be better than others, but like ideally it's sustained itself.
And at what point do you feel that it would not only just be safe, but fiscally worth it to open up your doors to dine-in service once again?
So right now, Eric's rearranging all the furniture in the restaurant just to see what that actually would look like with social distancing standards, meaning like the backs of your chairs have to be 6 feet from another chair back and a table. So it's not just your tables, it's the backs of your chairs. Outside dining is still 6 foot, right? You know, 6 foot, and that's back chair to back chair. Inside capacity does not affect your outside capacity. It just depends on, you know, how your tables can be spaced outside. With the city of Milwaukee doing the parklet program and the, you know, they're willing to extend, they're offering a pilot program for extending outdoor seating, then that means that the outside dining would have its own capacity as well. So we have capacity of 80. That means 25% of that is 20. Minus my staff, because they're included in that, which means in the all actuality, I'm probably looking at 7 to 12 people in here as customers. Now, for me to open up doors, to prep a menu, to do this and to staff, 12 people, even if I turned that three times, that's 36 people in a night. When we normally do 100 for brunch easily, and then we do, I would say, anywhere between 55 to 100, you know, a night, depending on the night of the week, you know, the rest of the week in general. Now, could I do that and supplement takeout? Yes. But is it worth it for me to prep a menu, X amount of food, hope that I sell it for those 12 people that I'm hoping are going to come in, you know, times three, meaning, you know, three turns a night or however that is. And even with the layout that we have, we're looking at maybe not even being able to seat all 12 people at once, because we may have to leave this table empty just because there's enough space to a point to accommodate this and not accommodate that. So I would feel it's probably worth it to me to be open more so with capacity at 50%, because then that opens it up to about 40. And then with staff, that means, you know, I'm probably, say, anywhere, you know, if I have anywhere between 5 and 7 staff members on. So we're looking at like 32 people then, okay? But that's only if social distancing guidelines can still be adhered. So the configuration of my restaurant with my tables, it just, I couldn't even do 50% capacity if we have to adhere to social distancing guidelines, just because of the space itself. So the outside aspect would actually be more beneficial to us being able to utilize the outside. So what we might think about doing then is, if that's the case, is we could easily just do more classes and go back to that and certain aspects on that to help supplement the money if we can't do the indoor dining like we normally do.
So when the city of Milwaukee announced the reopening, many restaurants had varied responses on both ends of the spectrum. And I'm wondering about the response that you've had from customers after you posted your decision to remain closed for dine-in services.
It's been really supportive, like really, really, really supportive. I would say it's been like 95% great and 5% not. And it depends. It's funny because since I'm a business owner, I'm not allowed to have an opinion. But I do anyways, because that's just who I am. And I feel like I'm more than welcome to have an opinion just like anyone else. I care about my staff and I care about my customers. And for me, I'm people over profit always. Right now, if I can sustain my business like this, it's not ideal. But if I can do it and if I'm smart about it, I should just keep doing this for as long as I have to until, you know, I call it like we're riding the wave and we're just going to see how long this is, you know, how long we can physically do this to until I'm forced to physically have to open my doors again. Because I don't want to get sick. I don't want my staff to get sick. I look at, you know, health insurance and things like that. Like majority of the restaurant industry doesn't have health insurance. They can't afford to get sick. You know, if someone would have to like get sick and go on a ventilator, I mean, what, and they come out of that, the amount of debt that they would be in just from that. And, you know, me being a very small business owner, trying to afford health insurance for my staff has been a battle. And I've been working with other business owners on it. It's been always a thing that we've talked about, like trying to be able to do these things and afford these things for our staff. But just like when you're looking at, we as a restaurant have a 3-4% profit margin. That's not a lot. So you think about, you know, if you bring in $30,000 a month, you're looking at 3% of that as your profit after your rent is paid and your bills are paid and your staff is paid. So then it's like, try to add health insurance on top of that. From an employer perspective, then you're going, you know, you're going down there more. Now you want to say, okay, well, then you could raise your prices. Well, that's great. But then if you raise your prices, are you still going to maintain the same level of business from the same customers? They're not going to understand why you're raising your prices. They're just going to see a price increase. So it's really hard to like try to figure out a good balance. But like I said, for me, it's more so just trying to keep everyone safe, because I don't know what I would do. I don't know that, you know, I mean, I'd all like to think that we're all healthy and that we'd all make it out of this, but you just don't know. And that's the scary thing about this, is you don't know who will have mild symptoms or who will end up hitting it really hard.
AJ Dixon is the chef and owner of the restaurant Lazy Susan in Bayview. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.